Welcome to The Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Brooke Verlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays, read by Leighton Pugh.
Nation and state versus Europe, when the sum of the parts is larger than the whole. Josef Joffe. Let me start with a discourse on linguistics before turning to the European Union. The German language offers a nice wordplay by drawing a distinction between Nationalstaat and Staatsnation. Nationalstaat translates easily into nation-state, which designates the identity between a cultural ethnic community rooted in primordial history and the political entity known as a state. As important as it is for our purpose, Staatsnation does not translate into English. It is the opposite of the nation-state that has been populating Europe since the middle of the last millennium, when England, France, and Spain bestrode the stage and set the model for the rest. By contrast, the Staatsnation is not based on blood, culture, and language, and thus Switzerland has four vernaculars. It is based on will. We, the people, want to live in a common house, no matter what our faith, race, or language. The EU is certainly no nation state, but neither is it a Staatsnation, as we shall soon see. The two best examples of willed nations are Switzerland and the United States. Switzerland, also known as Schweiz, Suisse, and Switzerer to its own citizens, consists of several ethnic communities that came together under a single political roof in the 14th century. Its founding myth is the Rütli Oath, which tells it all. It is rendered thus by poetic license in Friedrich Schiller's drama Wilhelm Tell. We want to be a single people of brethren, never to part in danger nor distress. We want to be free as our fathers were, and rather die than live in slavery. A few centuries later, this pledge would be echoed in the most famous slogan of the American Revolution, attributed to the founding father Patrick Henry. Give me liberty or give me death. Both Switzerland and the US were founded by an act of will. They did not arise from primordial national communities. They are nourished by a sense of common history and destiny. Like the Swiss, the Americans are a Staatsnation. Originally, the US started out as a WASP republic, effectively a copy of white Anglo-Saxon and Protestant Britain. It was peopled by Britons and based on the mother country's laws and institutions. 1,000 towns in the US are named after places in England: Birmingham, Leeds, Woodstock, Sheffield, Oxford. Yet the new country soon turned into a multi-ethnic, multi-religious state based on hallowed documents such as the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, or the Gettysburg Address. Anybody, whatever his or her belief or bloodline, can sign on to them and become an American. An early French observer of the American colonies, Hector St. John de Crèvecoeur, noticed a strange mixture of blood: English, Scots, Irish, French, Dutch, and Germans. Who, then, is an American? Asked Crèvecoeur. He has left behind all his ancient prejudices and manners, receives new ones from the new mode of life he has embraced, the new government he obeys. The American is a new man who acts on new principles. This new man lives in a willed nation. Americans, like the Swiss, have formed a Staatsnation, not a nation-state in the way of France or Poland. Israel is also a willed nation, founded by its Declaration of Independence in 1948 and peopled by 100 nationalities, yet it is also the state of the Jews, rooted in ethnicity and religion. The difference between these two types highlights the stubborn problem of the European Union. It is neither one nor the other, but suspended somewhere in between. The EU did not spring from a single act of will. It is a work in progress with many stations, from the founding in 1952 of the European Coal and Steel Community, ECSC, to the European Union, 1993. It consists of many nations, with sovereignty lodged in the various capitals. Each member state has its own history, identity, and language. They do not claim a common destiny. The sum of the parts is larger than the whole. There is no Staatsvolk, to use German again, hence no demos, to fall back on ancient Greek. As Harvard's political scientist Stanley Hoffman put it in his essay Fragments Floating in the Here and Now, in a 1979 edition of the journal Daedalus, Europe, in spite of its impressive record of functional integration, still remains a collection of largely self-enclosed nation-states. If the hostilities entailed by separate pasts appear to have evaporated, Europe's separate pasts have not. Please note that Hoffman wrote this almost 40 years ago, and yet the diagnosis still stands, even though, since then, European integration has proceeded by leaps and bounds, expanding from 6 to 28 members, soon to be minus the United Kingdom, and deepening at a similar pace. How then shall this, sui generis, turn into an e pluribus unum, like the US or Switzerland? There are 28 separate histories and cultures, and almost as many languages. The focus of loyalty is not on Brussels, but on Berlin, Paris, and Warsaw. The centres of power are the capitals as well. If Euroland has a common language, it is English with an American accent. The same goes for mass culture. Not to put too fine a point on it, Europe dresses, listens, dances, and watches American, happily wolfing down McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken fast food. Political debate unfolds at home, not in the European Parliament, nor in European-wide media. Basically, Europeans read and watch their own media, or they subscribe to Netflix and the Financial Times. How then might Europe gestate into a Staatsnation that rests on common will and common destiny? Europe did once have a common sense of history, which emerged from the horrors of the Second World War and translated into the pledge, never again. Never again shall we raise our swords against one another. Europe was to be an empire of peace. But that reservoir has been depleted, because the heirs of Adenauer, Schumann, and Monet no longer remember the cataclysm of the war. 70 years later, peace is not a gift, but a given. Back then, the young went off to the Franco-German border to break down the barriers in order to celebrate the transcendence of the nation-state. Until very recently, the EU took for granted Schengenland, the passport-free travel zone from Portugal to Poland. Now, border controls are back, in response to the flow of refugees and migrants from the Middle East and North Africa. To put it in a nutshell, the Germans and French look to Mrs. Merkel and Monsieur Macron and to their national parliaments, not to Ursula von der Leyen, President of the European Commission, nor to Strasbourg, the seat of the European Parliament. To put it in larger terms, the European project is bouncing up against its limits. The most dramatic blow is, of course, Brexit, turning seemingly endless expansion into secession. Second, the endless crisis over the euro warns that Europe has gone one bridge too far on the march to ever closer union by placing nations into a single monetary straitjacket that does not fit each and all. Third, the de facto suspension of Schengenland during the refugee crisis of 2015 to 2016 and the pandemic of 2020 to 2021 suggests that when it comes to the crunch, nations will hearken not to the call of community, but of sovereignty. Let us now put the problem in conceptual terms. The EU's founding documents, such as the Treaty of Paris, 1951, which established the ECSC, lacked the emotional punch of the Declaration of Independence, with its self-evident truths and the right and duty to throw off the yoke of absolute despotism and tyranny. Nor do Europe's founding acts duplicate the sacral nature of the mythical Swiss Rütli covenant. The operative faith or ideology was functionalism. If you integrate Sector A, you must soon integrate B, C, D, starting with coal and steel, the wherewithal of war-making. This approach reflected the faith in administrative inevitability. It was integration on the sly, if you will, not a lofty act of will underwritten by popular affirmation, as was the US Constitution. As it deepened, the functionalist approach, from coal to currency, was destined to creep ever closer to the core of national sovereignty and thus to sharpen the contradictions, as Karl Marx would have it. The mainstays of the nation-state, such as obligation and identity, did not grow pari passu, nor did European-wide political participation expand in the absence of a demos. Hence the populist revolt that arose as early as 2005, when the French voted no to a European constitution, followed by the Dutch 1 year later. The constitution was shelved and replaced by the Lisbon Treaty, which shifted power back to the states, as represented by the European Council. Almost all member states now have anti-European parties in their parliaments, and the populist revolt on the right and left, which gave us Brexit, will not soon subside. The handwriting stays on the wall. The central problem stems from Europe as an elite and bureaucratic project that collides with the demands of democratic mass participation. Such an unemotional, bloodless venture is not powerful enough to generate an e pluribus unum collective, especially since the various national elites are themselves at loggerheads over the course and purpose of the European Union. Compare Germany and its civil religion of Europeanism not only with Britain, but also with Poland and Hungary, and their resurgent nationalism. Brexit is an obvious case in point. The referendum of 2016 spelled secession, no matter what the costs. Warsaw and Budapest love the subsidies, but hate giving up sovereignty. Sweden was the first member to close its borders against unwanted immigration. Club Med, the European countries of the southern tier, rail against the German diktat on fiscal discipline and painful reforms to improve competitiveness. Berlin, in turn, professes its love of Europe most loudly, but resents new integrationist ventures that would dilute monetary discipline under the euro and increase Germany's liability for the debts of the rest. The Germans try to mould the EU in their own image, if ever so softly, by deploying their economic clout. The French, with their statist culture and centralised institutions, seek to impose their own ways. Following in the footsteps of his predecessors, Sarkozy and Hollande, President Macron wants a common investment budget for the Eurozone and a common finance minister. In other words, he would like to get France's hands on the community's resources in order to alleviate fiscal constraints and reformist pressures à l'Allemande. This ancient struggle between dirigisme and competitive markets, reflecting separate histories and social contracts, will not subside soon in a European construction where the nation-state has the last word. While the nation-state will not abdicate, please note that the departure of Britain will change the balance of power within the EU. Here is the constitutional arithmetic. It takes at least four member states representing more than 35% of the EU population to muster a veto against a qualified majority based on 55% of the member states and 65% of the EU population. Without 65 million Britons, a blocking minority against a coalition led by France will be hard to achieve. So Britain's secession might indeed make the EU more cohesive, yet at the price of consistently outvoting the minority composed of Germany and its freer market cohort. That kind of cohesion is not likely to strengthen unity, but deepen the rifts between Club Med and Club North. The moral of this tale should not come as a surprise. The nation-state has proven the sturdiest political institution of the last 500 years, and longevity obviously reflects functionality and good health. Having started out with 50 members, the UN now encompasses 193 states. Willed nations like Switzerland and the US remain exceptions, while Europe is far from becoming one because its members are evidently unwilling to give up their ancient powers lodged in national sovereignty. What is the future of the European Union? The EU is sui generis. It certainly cannot be a nation-state, not with its separate histories and cultures. Nor is it destined to turn into a Staatsnation, or willed nation, that sets aside the past on the march to an E pluribus unum. Then what? The best answer is a biological metaphor. Let's liken this European creature to a coral reef. This organism obeys no stringent design, but it lives and spreads. It is built by myriad microscopic animals. It doesn't have a telos or preordained destiny. Some parts break off, others grow again, and new branches sprout in all directions. To complete the analogy to the EU, unless hammered by an outside force or dissolved by contaminated waters, coral reefs are virtually indestructible. Brexit or not, it is a safe bet that the European reef will also endure.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.